Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we are going to take on the issue of constitutional rights, land rights, and human rights. This is more than what would happen between a rancher in Nevada and the government represented by the Bureau of Land Management in deciding that the person, because he had used lands, had not paid grazing fees, that his cattle should be confiscated, with a group of 200 law enforcement, including multiple snipers and the FBI. And this did not lead to a Ruby Ridge or Waco escalation with catastrophic injury or death, because the government decided at the last moment to back down. I believe that was a wise decision. But what the mainstream media has refused to discuss is the larger context in which this drama played out. There was no looking at the government agencies, either the Interior Department or the Bureau of Land Management, for that matter, even the Bureau of Indian Affairs. How do we use our natural resources? Who exploits them? What right do we have in how this is done? When you consider gas hydrofracking, coal extraction, oil extraction, and the pollution that comes from this, when you look at what rights the local citizens have, when you look at the incidents of this very same bureau impacting the wild Mustang, one of the greatest symbols, one of the last living symbols of wild animal herds in the United States, why do they need to call them? Their excuses have never held weight. So we intend to look not at the cattle, not at the rancher. That is really, in my opinion, secondary. What is important is to examine the bureaucracy behind this. It is my contention, and I will see what my guests have to say, that there's been an enormous overreach. And we're going to have a panel discuss this. Included in the panel will be Dr. William Perry Bendley. Dr. Bendley is the president of Mountain States Legal Foundation in Colorado. He served in the Reagan administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Energy and Minerals at the Department of Interior. In fact, he authored President Reagan's National Minerals Policy. We'll be asking him specifically about the idea of freedom of speech, because we were informed that there would be a free speech zone. For me, this raised a red flag, because I wasn't aware that you could only exercise free speech, your constitutional free speech, in a officially designated spot. And if you went beyond that spot, you risked arrest or ending up on someone's list. I remember at the national conventions for both Republicans and Democrats, both had these free speech zones. They're becoming so common now that rarely are they challenged. We'll challenge this today. We also have today Karen Sussman. Karen has been the president of the International Society for the Protection of Mustangs and Burros on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. That's the nation's oldest wild horse protection organization, where she manages four different wild horse herds. Today, she is highly regarded as the leading expert in wild horse management. She has saved thousands of wild horses over the years from captivity and slaughter. In the past, she has served on the advisory board of the Secretary of the Interior and the Secretary of Agriculture. She's received numerous awards. She's appeared on CNN, Fox, Animal Planet, NPR, Good Morning America, and others. She will be joined by Amy Mall. Amy from Washington, D.C., is a senior policy analyst in the Land and Wildlife Program of the Natural Resource Defense Council. Her expertise is in the policies that protect natural resources and the environment from irresponsible industrial development, including harmful oil and gas exploration production operations. She's also worked to conserve national forest wildlands and wildlife habitat. Before working for the Natural Defense Fund. Amy worked in the private sector, in county, state, and federal government, including the White House National Economic Council and the U.S. Senate. She's a graduate from Harvard University and Cornell University. But we're beginning our program today with Rob Maraca. He is a senior scientist at the Public Lands Program in Nevada for the Center for Biological Diversity, a national organization dedicated to the preservation of the biodiversity of wildlife and flora hovering on the brink of extinction and the environmental protection of lands, water, and climate necessary for the survival of species. Before joining the center, Bob was an officer in the U.S. Air Force, a 28-year career with U.S. Forestry Service, including time spent as the supervisor of Utah's Fish Lake National Forest, and a forest ecologist. Most recently, he was the manager of the Clark County, Nevada Environmental Planning Division. He also has degrees from State University of New York, College of Environmental Science and Forestry, as well as a master's in forestry ecology from Washington State University. And the center's website is biologicaldiversity.org. I welcome all of you to the program, and let's say hello to Robert. Nice to have you with us today, Robert.
Thanks, Gary. It's Rob.
Rob, explain to us, please, what the public generally does not understand about several interlocking issues. First, how bureaucracies and those working within the bureaucracies view the land that should be something we hold in common, something that is open for the public to use, versus how do special corporate interests view that same land, and then how is it that almost, well, the majority of the time, not always, it's the corporate interests that decide what they want to do, where they're going to do it, and how much of our land they're going to use and what the consequences are to our water, our mountaintops, our valleys, our deserts. Take us through this so we get a better understanding of what we're dealing with.
I'll give it my try, Gary. I think it's important to understand that the Western public lands, specifically those managed by the Bureau of Land Management, were the lands that nobody wanted. When states acquired statehood, particularly west of the Mississippi River, they put a request in for what lands they wanted to be, given to the state for private development and privatizations, and the lands they didn't want were leftover lands, and those reverted back to the federal government to manage. Some lands, like those high in mountain ranges where water sheds had their origins, were important enough that they were set aside as national forest reserves and national forests. But the other lands, the more arid lands down lower, were the Bureau of Land Management lands, the lands that nobody wanted. So because of that, these lands have always suffered from the stigma of they were essentially wastelands and worthless and were open for any kind of development opportunities because they didn't have any value otherwise. And, quite honestly, as we began to learn more and more about these lands and understand ecology and ecosystems better, these lands are quite important, even though they're not the headwaters of the streams that supply our water supply.
Take us through what your concerns are, and also the Public Lands Program in Nevada and the Center for Biological Diversity. Why should we be concerned about how the Bureau of Land Management is engaging with the lands that you say that at one time were considered of little value, and now we're seeing they do have value, and how does that impact we the people?
Yeah, well, I think it's important, first of all, to get back to one of your initial questions, and it had to do something about the people that work for the federal agencies on the ground and how they view the land. And I can tell you that from my experience, the vast majority of federal land managing employees care deeply about the land and the communities in which they live. And it's only when politics gets involved that trumps good science and good decision-making that we end up with problems. The Bureau of Land Management, largely under Republican administrations, has become known as the Bureau of Livestock and Mining. And we see that happening through the policies that the in programs that the various administrations apply. Getting to Nevada, the BLM lands in Nevada are under siege right now from a variety of interests. First off, among them is water issues. Water in Nevada is a critical issue. Nevada is the driest state in the union. The majority of the state is occupied by two great deserts, the Great Basin Desert as well as the Mojave Desert, which is the driest desert in North America. The 90s saw explosive growth in southern Nevada, and specifically the Las Vegas Valley where I live. I mean, we were seeing 6,000 or more new residents coming in each month. To deal with that, the water provider, the Southern Nevada Water Authority, started to do long-term planning for how to supply water to that growing community and a growing community that would continue to grow. It's important to know that 90% of the water used in Las Vegas Valley comes out of the Colorado River. And Nevada, under Colorado River law, received the smallest allocation of river water of any of the states that receive water from the Colorado River. So rather than having an intelligent discussion on growth and conservation, what the Southern Nevada Water Authority did was propose a groundwater exportation problem that would take groundwater from ancient aquifers in central Nevada and eastern Utah and ship it via a 300-mile pipeline to Las Vegas Valley to fuel exponential non-sustainable growth. And the Center for Biological Diversity and myself, as well as a coalition called the Great Basin Water Network, have been fighting this project now since 2004. And we actually are quite successful in our efforts of battling the Goliath. The Great Basin Water Network has a budget of around $100,000 a year, up against a couple hundred million dollar budgets of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. And what that water pipeline project would do would take approximately 29 billion gallons of water every year from an aquifer that's left over from the last ice age and then, like I said, pipe it to Las Vegas Valley. And right now, where we are in the process is the Bush administration, W. Bush administration, wanted to help facilitate this project. So to make sure it went the way the administration wanted, they embedded a Washington, D.C. political appointee in Nevada to ride herd over the environmental compliance process, or NEPA process. So lo and behold, at the end of the process, the Bureau of Land Management decided to grant a right-of-way to the Southern Nevada Water Authority for the pipeline to pump all of this water. Well, we and our allies are now in federal district court challenging that record of decision for that NEPA process. Along the way, at least 15 species of desert fish would go extinct. Sage grouse, mule deer, Rocky Mountain elk, pronghorn would be severely impacted by the drying of springs and watersheds. And local ranching families and rural communities that don't have a Colorado River in their backyard and need that same groundwater if they are to prosper and grow would be deprived of that resource. So that's just one example in my experience where politics have trumped good land management within the Bureau of Land Management.
I appreciate those insights, especially when you consider that 20 states in the United States now have so little water and their aquifers are so depleted, including California, Texas, Oklahoma, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, Kansas, among these states, plus Georgia over on the East Coast and most of Florida, that you will not be able to sustain in the future the cities that are there now. And, of course, the problem is one of the very first people who are affected are the ranchers and the farmers. They get their water cut off or reallocated, as is happening right now in California, where nearly 2 million acres have been taken out of production. Old almond orchards are being torn down. One town, which is the cantaloupe capital of America that grew the most cantaloupes for decades, is now virtually a dust bowl with 11,000 unemployed people. Unemployment there is over 40%. And yet we're not addressing these needs. As long as the people in the cities get their water, as long as the heavy industries get their water, then we're considered okay. But it's not okay. And I'm concerned that we have misallocated our natural resources. And it's not because we're not smart enough, nor are there people who care enough, as you and other people within the forestry department and land departments do. It's because people coming in with their lobbyists, political appointees, and then they deem the policy that has to go forward. And I think that the public should be made aware of this. Remember, this is the same group of people, for example, in 2008, who were caught in broad ethics scandals regarding drugs and graft and royalty collections from oil and energy industry, and concern the Mineral Management Division that collects about $10 billion in oil and gas royalties annually, and yet nothing happens. You know, it's like the famous Teapot Dome scandal of 1929 when the secretary convicted of bribery for transferring U.S. Navy oil leases to the Department of Interior. Today, nothing happens. So we have to become aware of the larger problem if we're to save our natural resources, save our forests, save our lakes, save our water, for the people who need it, and not just build artificial cities and then say, well, the city's here, the commerce is here, the money's here, the lobbies are here, so we'll drain our water into this. It's just foolish. And I thank you for the good work you're doing.
You know, Gary, they talk about quite often how water flows to money, and that's definitely what's true unless we stand up and say no.
Well, for 28 years you were with the Forest Service, including a supervisor of Utah's Fish Lake National Forest, and you're a forest ecologist. You care about the people, you care about the forest, and care about its proper management. Thank you for doing the good work. And the group Center for Biological Diversity in Nevada, the website is biologicaldiversity.org. What we're going to do now, we're going to go to Dr. William Perry, and Dr. William Perry Pendley, and hear what he has to say on the Bureau of Land Management, the stripping away of America's constitutional rights and liberties, because that was an important part of the problem. Let us go to our next guest now, Dr. William Perry Pendley. Dr. Perry Pendley is the president and chief operating officer in the firm of Mountain States Legal Foundation in Lakewood, Colorado. In the past, he served as an attorney to former Senator Clifford Hansen from Wyoming and to the House Interior and Insular Affairs Committee. And during the Reagan administration, Dr. Pendley was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Energy and Minerals at the Department of Interior and authored President Reagan's National Minerals Policy. And he has worked in private practice in Washington, D.C. and now in Colorado. And he served as a captain in the Marine Corps and as a JD with the University of Wyoming College of Law. He writes monthly columns, and he is also the author of four books, the latest two being Sagebrush Rebel and Warriors of the West. His website is mountainstatelegal.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you.
Although I would like to focus on the larger legal issues and problems of the Bureau of Land Management instead of the Bundy Ranch case going on in Nevada, this case does give an example of, in my personal opinion, and I'm not a lawyer, the unconstitutionality of the agency, what is known as the Enclave Clause in the Constitution, authorizing Congress to purchase, own, and control land in a state under specific and limited conditions, namely to build forts, dockyards, arsenals, which strictly concern the federal right on matters of war and peace, rather than to protect endangered animals such as the tortoise that's being claimed by the Bureau of Land Management now, or so we're told by the agency. Then the larger picture is the centralized government's right to overstep state sovereignty. So can you please speak on the constitutional and legal issues behind the Bundy case and then broaden this to expand our understanding of the activities of the Bureau of Land Management, and in what ways are the actions regarded as legal or illegal?
I think the major concern right here as we look at the Bundy situation is the incredible overreaction by the part of the federal government. I've seen this happen time and time again, especially to Westerners on federal land engaged in activities that are certainly permissible, part of the federal land law, and authorized by court opinions for decades. But when you have these kinds of infractions where the federal government comes in, they really have a tendency to overreact, and I think that's what we're seeing with the Bundy situation in Nevada. Now, this situation is gone on in the past. Now, what springs to mind is Ruby Ridge during the administration of George Herman Walker Bush, Waco, of course, during the Bill Clinton administration under the Attorney General at the time from Florida. But this is uniquely, I think, a Obama problem, simply because from its earliest days, the Obama administration has targeted so-called anti-government groups, unquote, in the West especially, as sources of domestic terrorism. And, in fact, Janet Napolitano had a report prepared that described anti-government groups, pro-gun groups, states' rights groups, and others as sources of domestic terrorism, and then sent that report to law enforcement agencies all across the country from coast to coast. And there was a rash of arrests in response to that report, and it continues to inform the administration with regard to, okay, who are these people, and what should be our attitude toward them. And I think that that's the reason we see this terrible overreaction on the ground in Nevada.
I'm concerned also about having 200 plus militarized individuals, including snipers, who are sent in to what is a relatively minor matter, and then they set up a free speech area so that they're assuring safety for the agents. Where is America not a free speech nation? I'm of the belief that if you have to say you can only have free speech in this limited area, that that's unconstitutional. And another constitutional violation of that free speech is how many times now they're looking at anyone in the United States, in any movement, who says that our rights are being trampled upon, and suddenly they're on a watch list. Yeah, if it's human rights, no matter what it is, you protest anything in the United States today, you're going to be on a watch list.
There's a famous saying by a friend of mine, and that universities are islands of tyranny in a sea of liberty, and that's increasingly the situation we have with the federal government. There is an operative premise on the part of the Obama administration that we only have certain enumerated rights, and the federal government has unlimited powers to do whatever it is it wants. People who engaged in the decision to bring 200 law enforcement officials to this place to bring in snipers have clearly not benefited from the Ruby Ridge and the Waco exercises. Of course, it was Ruby Ridge, famously, where a sniper shot through the door of the cabin in which the man who was being sought was located, and tragically killed his wife. You would think that people who have experience in this area would say, well, we sure don't want to replicate Ruby Ridge. We don't want to duplicate Waco, but obviously wiser heads are not prevailing in decisions about taking whatever action is necessary.
When you look at the Bureau of Land Management, you are familiar with some of their malfeasance acts. Could you explain why the mainstream media, by the way, has not focused at all upon the Interior Department of the Bureau of Land Management's own problems historically?
I've had experience in dealing with the Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, the Environmental Protection Agency. And the overriding lesson that I would communicate to your listeners is simply this, that generally federal employees do a decent job. But there is the phenomena that when people are given the kinds of power these people have, they have a tendency to abuse them. And when those things occur, when there are abuses, violations of law, even fraud, and somebody on the outside brings it to the attention of the United States government, more particularly federal lawyers, instead of being greeted with, oh, my goodness, we're so glad you brought that to our attention, we need to do something about that, instead the attorneys, the federal employees circle the wagon and say, we're going to defend these people, even when, frankly, what they ought to be doing is figuring out how they get them indicted. We've had a couple of situations in where clearly federal employees violated the law, violated the rights of citizens, and were not held accountable for it. And when I've had a situation where I've gone to members of Congress and pointed these situations out, they almost always say, well, the situation's in litigation, and we really can't become involved. And so the normal checks and balances that would exist there where Congress would say, well, this agency's out of control, we have to rein it in, those don't exist today.
I believe that if you're going to hold a standard, you should have one standard. If you create malfeasance, theft, lies, fraud, or any criminal act in a private corporation, a private business, your own home-based business, or small business, or a major Fortune 500 company, the same rules should apply to any government agency or government officials or government employees. Your thought?
Well, that's absolutely the case. You can imagine if this were not BLM, but XYZ Corporation, a massive multilateral corporation that engaged in analogous conduct here, and people would be calling for their heads. They'd say, who's the CEO, and what did he know, and when did he know it, and why in the world did he allow his employees to do this? But that's not the question being asked in Washington. The mainstream media types are saying, see, so what's going on with that crazy cowboy out there? And why are the militia arming themselves and showing up on his property? It's a bizarre world when those kinds of questions get asked instead of the one that you raised, which is, well, shouldn't we hold these people accountable to the same standard we demand of other entities, business entities or universities or enterprises?
My final question, final question for you is this. I believe in the Constitution, and I believe in the Bill of Rights. I believe that that's where we start and where we should end discussions, where we make rules and laws. And yet, what I have seen with several administrations are the overreaching effects of taking away our constitutional rights, like habeas corpus. Right now, there is no real habeas corpus protected by the Constitution, unreasonable search and seizures, and even free speech. So many of our rights no longer are what our founding fathers believed they should be, and yet we're not having a discussion in the mainstream media, in our major institutions of higher education, about this whole idea of witnessing the erosion and redefining of our constitutional rights, not just as the Bureau of Land Management determines it, but across other federal agencies like the FDA and Health and Human Services. I'd like to hear your assessment of how our constitutional rights and liberties are being eroded by centralized government, and for whose ultimate benefit is the Constitution being reinterpreted, and for what ultimate reason?
You're absolutely right. This is a conversation we would need to be having, and if we were living in the days of our founding fathers, this would be topic one at every tavern and meeting hall and way station in the colonies. The fact that it's not shows how superficial we are, or how far we're removed from the inspiration of our founding fathers, or how soft we've become. We turn on the television and we zone out. I do know that last December, the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on the Judiciary had a hearing, brought in four professors, two conservatives or libertarians, and two liberals, how they found two conservative law professors, I don't know, but they did. And to the professor, they proclaimed that what was happening under President Obama, although the liberals, of course, liked his policies, they said this is a serious erosion of the checks and balances, the way our system and our republic is supposed to operate, and it's very worrisome. And of course, that was on Fox News. Rush talked about it. Hannity talked about it. But you won't hear that conversation almost anywhere else. And in fact, most people are unaware of that committee hearing ever went on. But that, you're absolutely right. That's a conversation we ought to be having. The Bundy, Cliven Bundy case ought to be a reason we talk about it. We've got a man in Wyoming who's being threatened by the EPA because he put in a stock watering pond, and his life is turned upside down. And this story is replicated all across the country, and it's a dangerous and worrisome time.
I appreciate what you're doing to challenge these overreaches on behalf of the American public. Thank you very much, Dr. William Perry Pendley.
Have a great day.
Constitutional scholar and lawyer who shared his insights. I'm Gary. Now let's go over to say hello to Amy Ma in Washington, D.C. Nice to have you with us, Amy.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Amy, I'm concerned that at a time when we should be looking for the least polluting resources that are renewable, because we know the devastation to our environment. I come from Appalachia in West Virginia, and I can tell you if the average American spent a week traveling, which is a tiny state, you can drive from one end of the state to the other in about 3 hours. You can drive across it in 2 hours. If they were spending time where people do not have clean drinking water, don't have clean air to breathe, everything has a coat of pollution on it, they would have a little different perspective about clean coal, that oxymoron. And if you couldn't drink your water because of gas hydrofracking or some other fossil fuel resources being exploited, and you realized the state wasn't protecting you, the federal government wasn't protecting you, you would say, why am I not able as an American to have the freedom to have healthy environment to live in, a healthy environment? And yet that's what we find. And at the heart of this is the Bureau of Land Management and the Interior Department opening up so much of our commons, our forest, for hydrofracking and other fossil fuel resource exploration. And yet we don't seem to learn any lessons. We didn't learn a single lesson from British Petroleum causing that spill in the Gulf. They lied, it turned out. They lied about everything. And then we have politicians in these states who accept enormous amounts of money from these major industries and then swing a legislation or swing enactment or put pressure upon these agencies to go soft on these big guys. But then you get someone who gets slammed who wants to do the right thing. Your thoughts on this? Take us through what you're doing, what you've seen, and what you believe we have to do.
Well, we at the Natural Resources Defense Council are also very concerned about fossil fuel development on our public lands, and it's happening across the country, from California all the way to Virginia, and in the Midwest as well as in the Southeast. And these lands belong to all Americans. They're managed on our behalf by the federal government, but they are very valuable for many different things. And we have laws in place that are supposed to protect the environmental values, the clean air and the clean water that these lands provide, as well as recreational opportunities and a lot of business for local economies and many, many different uses for hunting and fishing, et cetera. But we are concerned that for too long now, the scales have been tipped in favor of the oil and gas industry and the coal industry, and it's something that we continue to see more and more of. The oil and gas leasing continues to go on, and under the Obama administration, to be fair, they have put some new practices in place that make the leasing a little bit more protective and better planned than it was under the Bush administration, but it's still too far balanced in favor of the oil and gas industry. And there are many wildland areas that we don't think should be leased and aren't being protected. Many of these areas, as one of your earlier guests said, in the national forests are actually very important drinking watersheds. So, for example, I'm in Washington, D.C., and not too far from here, about 100 miles away, is the George Washington National Forest, which industry wants to be allowed to frack in. Right now it's not allowed there, which is the right thing for the agency to do because it's such an important drinking water source as well as important national forest for the D.C. metro area. And so, you know, we're very concerned about all these areas being opened up. And we're also working to make sure that there are renewable energy opportunities on our public lands. And again, renewable energy still has and can have negative impacts. So we're working hard to make sure that the renewable energy is sited in the right places where it will cause the least harm. But right now, for renewable energy, it actually can be more challenging to site than for fossil fuel energy, which doesn't make any sense. The oil and gas industry gets a lot of special treatment under our federal rules, and they are also exempt from some of our most important environmental protections in our federal laws. So we're extremely concerned about this huge push by the industry to continue to lease oil and gas on our public lands all across America. A lot of people do think it's in the Rocky Mountain region, and that's where a lot of this development started and really exploded from around 2000 to around 2005, but then it really started opening up in all these other parts of the country on our national forests in Mississippi and Alabama and in Ohio. And on public lands in California, and so it's really become a national issue, not just a Western issue. And even in national forests, while that does not come under the Department of Interior, it actually comes under the Department of Agriculture. If there is oil and gas leasing in a national forest, the BLM under the Department of Interior actually does the leasing, and the BLM's rules apply. Now, the Obama administration did propose a new rule for fracking on public lands that the BLM issued in draft form, but unfortunately it's much too weak and does not do anything close to what we think it needs to do to actually protect drinking water sources. It's focused on drinking water sources. And so they will probably be issuing a final rule later this year, but we are very concerned that it will be too weak, and it's just another example of the oil and gas industry having much too much influence in Washington.
Also, the special interest groups make sure that every major department has a representative or a stay behind, because every administration can appoint upwards between 1,400 and 1,700 people. These frequently become permanent employees, and then they are there to protect the interest, the policy interest, the ideology interest of the administration that put them in power. So it doesn't matter. If you go to the EPA, if you go to U.S. Public Health Service, if you go to the Interior Department, you're still faced with people who have their idea of who should be given the rights and who should be denied those rights. For example, the most abundant form of energy imaginable, 20,000 times more available, is geothermal. When was the last time you heard of any news outlet talking about geothermal the springs we have all over the United States, thousands of these springs. You have a country like Iceland that has a substantial technology advantage because it's learned how to use its geothermal springs, its volcanic energy to heat streets and other places. We don't do anything with that. Look at wave power, using waves all around the United States, including in the East River. We have a wave station, and it works, and it doesn't pollute, and it's inexpensive, and it's a proven technology. Where do you see us using this? Look in the Great Rockies. Look up in the Rockies where you don't have a personal habitat, which would be an interference, where you could put the wind power in the Great Continental Divide, but you don't see it. So what I'm saying is that how we could be using renewables, we're not. What we should be doing, we're not funding. And we keep throwing more money, hundreds of billions of dollars, in subsidies and tax breaks and incentives, in effect welfare for the corporate Americans, into coal and gas, nuclear and oil. And we're not paying attention to the outcomes of these. We've helped close 4 nuclear power plants. These are very dangerous. We see Fukushima. We've been lied to about the effects of Fukushima, both by the Japanese government and by our own. There are now fish in Canada that are being shown to be polluted with cesium, and yet we're not told about this. The Canadian government didn't even tell its citizens. The people in the area got their own radiation measuring devices and showed this, and they took it to the university, who confirmed this, but it wasn't news everywhere. So I don't believe that these bureaucracies at this point, because of being so politicized and corporatized, are capable of being honest with the American public and treating us with the respect and dignity that we, the people, deserve. Somehow, if you protest, I can promise you this, Amy, every single person that showed up to give the Bundy family some moral support to stand with them when 200 government agents, including snipers, were on them and an attack dog was on them, every one of those people are now going to be on a watch list. Everyone's going to be on some kind of localized terrorist list because they actually confronted the government. I'm involved in the environmental movement for 40 years. I'm involved in exposing the corruption that the FDA did. We were doing a documentary of the war on health and on genetic engineering, Seeds of Death, just this year. And when I do this, I ask the people, are you aware that when you join any protest in the United States, any movement at all, the government is now going to consider you no different than a local terrorist? We saw it with the Occupy group, where every person's could be photographed and filmed, was so by the FBI and Homeland Security. We weren't told this. We find this out later by Edward Snowden. So I don't like the idea. I don't like this idea at all, that we, the people, should be considered domestic terrorists because we are exercising our constitutional right of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and freedom of protest. Your thoughts, please.
Well, you know, I really can talk about oil and gas development on public lands. And one thing that's important to know about that is that it is coming closer and closer to where people live. And so you do see a lot more people in communities concerned about their health and their quality of life and their livelihoods and their property values. And typically, or traditionally, a lot of the oil and gas development on public lands was in very, very, very rural areas where not that many people lived, and not that much attention was paid to the impacts that it would have on communities and families. And now a lot more of that development is coming to where people live, and a lot more people are moving out to these areas because they're beautiful and because people want clean air and clean water. And so there is a lot more concern about the health impacts, the safety, and the environmental impacts for communities, not just wildlands and wildlife. And what you're seeing that's really interesting is that this is not really a Democrat or Republican issue. This is a nonpartisan issue in that you might have Democratic or Republican politicians that are very supportive of the oil and gas industry, but you also have Democratic or Republican citizens that are very concerned about the impacts that the oil and gas industry are having on their communities and that are joining together to fight for more protections. And in this case, what I've seen is that communities want more government involvement in the industry. They want stronger laws and they want stronger enforcement. When it comes to the oil and gas industry, they are regularly violating the laws. Our penalties are not strong enough to provide them with an incentive to comply with all the laws. And so whether it's a small company or a big company, you see a lot of repeat violations because they can afford to pay a small fine because they're very wealthy companies, as you know. So when it comes to the oil and gas industry, what communities are asking for is more government presence, stronger laws, stronger enforcement, strict penalties to really hold these companies accountable because they're operating right in people's backyards, not just on wild lands far away from communities. Because in some states right now, there are battles over whether or not local governments have the authority to restrict fracking within their boundaries. And industry is suing local governments. In Colorado, the state has said it's suing local governments because local governments want to protect their communities and their citizens. And so it's raising this oil and gas development, fracking across the country is really raising a lot of issues. But as I said, typically what we're seeing is people want more protection from their decision makers and their elected officials.
I agree. The trouble is I consider most of those elected officials compromised at so many levels. Look at the states. You're aware, Amy, that for 35 years, no American outside of those who were complicit was aware of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that was meeting at least twice a year, gave over 20,000 draft bills that became laws within states that benefited about 300 major corporations. And that was wrong. When a small group of people violate the one person, one vote rule, they brought in money, they influenced local legislators, legislators got on their side. The same has been going on forever at the federal level. I believe that we should have more control over our lives at the local level because it's the local persons. Let them debate. Let them decide. Let them have some say-so because where you say the people want the government to intervene, which government are we talking about? The government of the people, for the people, by the people, or the government of big corporations and big lobbying firms and the Koch brothers? Which government? And I know that you're all doing good work down there, and I thank you very much, Amy Maul, for the National Natural Resource Defense Council's efforts on our behalf. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's complete our discussion today by going out to South Dakota and saying hello to Karen Sussman. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
Karen, when I see what they've done to the horses in the past and the excuses they've given for rounding them up and slaughtering them, I'm appalled. This is the Bureau of Land Management, the very same people who were not challenged by Fox or anyone else about the stupidness of their policies when it comes to how they take care of our land and the wildlife. Tell us about what has been done or would have been done. I don't think we'd have had a wild horse left had it not been for you and other people getting involved in challenging the Bureau of Land Management. Give us the story, please.
Well, in 1971, our first president, Wild Horse Annie, was instrumental in a 26-year fight that brought the first law to protect wild horses and burros from being slaughtered. That was in 1971. And during that period, it was a very environmental period. Many laws came about, and then came the backlash of the Sagebrush Rebellion, which was to take back federal lands. But at that time, wild horses were just about completely eliminated. There were about 60,000 left of the 2 to 3 million wild horses that were there at the turn of the century from 1875 on. So when you think about it, having only 60,000 left was just a mere amount that, you hope that we would be able to preserve. Today, though, this is what is very interesting. In view of the law in 1971 that came about, and it passed unanimously through both houses of Congress, and it was something that the American people believed in. These are the icons. These represent the freedom, the symbols of America. And to think that today we have half the number of wild horses that existed in 1971, when horses, the law states horses were fast disappearing from the American scene, and it was important for us to be able to protect them. So today we now have half the number, and we fear that in the next 10 to 15 years it's going to be cut in half again.
Why?
I do believe that it is always for the last blade of grass on public lands. These horses live in areas, in 303 areas initially in 1971, where it was the most rugged land. It was the least usable land, and the horses were pushed to these areas to exist. And often just the same thing that happened to Native Americans. They were given land that was not tillable, highly mountainous and rolling hills, and basically it's grazing land where the natives are. But that's exactly the same thing that happened to wild horses. They were put in lands that no cattle, no other animals could exist. And so they survived there quite well because, as you know, animals are native to our continent. They evolved here for 60 million years over that period in the North American continent, and so they can adapt quite readily. And in doing so, the government continued to be able to use more and more land. So during the Reagan administration, they developed waters throughout the different areas on the land so that they could increase production of cattle. And basically what that did is it brought cattle into areas where wild horses and wildlife were, which were uninhabitable by cattle. But what it did was increase the devastation of the American rangelands. So in the last 100 years, we have had a almost static trend and very little improvement in the rangelands. And at some point, I think we're looking now at satellite pictures done by and Alan Savory's determinations looking at this also is to say that we are going through desertification in the West, which means the West is eventually going to become a desert. And I just wanted to kind of state that, you know, the wise people in 1875 and 1880, these were all the great chiefs of the nations, and they said, those who fall in their nest will not survive. And I love their simplistic language because that's exactly what's happening to us right now.
America right now is seeing the polluters pollute our ocean, pollute our rivers, our valleys. You can't find clean water in much of America today because you have some form of pollution. And I think it's just terrible that one of the greatest symbols of America's freedom, the great horse, the Mustang, is being eradicated because the Bureau of Land Management is not caring enough about the horses nor the proper management of land. And this is just wrong, but we have to become aware of a problem before we can solve it. And I appreciate that you're giving us this awareness. Are there films on this, documentaries that we could watch?
Well, there are some documentaries out. They haven't made it out into the public yet, but I just wanted to share this with the audience today because our organization has been the leader in wild horse and burro protection. And not only did we bring the law to save the wild horses, we created the adoption program so that the government would not kill the horses in the wild, but found a great use for them. And that's one reason I'm involved, because I adopted a wild horse. But the most important work that we're doing right now is we're managing four wild herds here in South Dakota. And for the past 15 years, we have been studying their social behaviors. And what we have found, which is extraordinary information, is that the way the BLM has managed the herds to go in and disrupt their intricate social structures every 3 years by removing them has destroyed their wonderful educational program and has caused an increase in the production and fertility of these animals. And so we have done nothing with our horses except love and take care of them and make sure they get the best care. And to give you an example of never removing and disrupting their families here in 15 years, our one herd has just doubled in 14 years. And with the storm now, we can say they've only doubled in 15 years. BLM's herds, they comment that they double every 4 years. And so we have wasted American taxpayer dollars by disrupting those horses when, in essence, they should have been protected. But it has been BLM's effort ever since the beginning of the act. They are the same agency that in the early 30s asked that they annihilate and shoot the horses on these lands. And this is the agency that's now managing these horses. So does it surprise us that we have half the number of herd areas left in the United States and the horses are far threatened more than they ever were prior to the 1971 law when Mustangers were rounding them up and killing them?
I appreciate the good work that you, Susan Sussman, and your International Society for the Protection of Mustangs and Burros on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation are doing out in South Dakota. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the end of our hour on the Progressive Commentary Hour. This, I believe, was important to share because if we didn't hear about what the Bureau of Land Management, the Interior Department, and other related agencies are doing to abuse our land, to threaten the life that we should have and the resources we should have, to always align themselves with the corporate interest and not the American public, to consider we, the people, as somehow an inconvenient threat to their domain, then we don't have the whole story. Hopefully now we have a better look at what the Bundy family was involved in with their cattle and their lease and not paying it. That is not the full story. Thank you for listening.